So again, in this session, we'll start with meditation, of course, the shamatha practice. So again, we'll do two 20-minute sessions with a two-minute break. And we're going to return again to focusing at the entrance of the nostrils. Okay, so let's find a nice, comfortable posture.
I have a question. The nostrils or a point...
Whichever works better for you. So anywhere in this area here, some people find... focusing on the area above the upper lip, this little area, is easier. Some people find the actual entrance of the nostrils is easier. So whichever you find easier, anywhere in this area is fine.
Exhaling or inhaling while counting?
Generally, it's better to count at the end of the inhale. Because, yeah, when you... finish the inhale, then you count, and then you exhale, focus on the sensations on the exhale and inhale, because often when you count at the end of the exhale, you sort of rush the exhale.
Just in between.
Yeah, right, yeah. One thing I didn't mention that is now I thought about it, it's a good point, is often when people do counting, and if you don't find counting helpful, some people just find it a distraction, then don't use it. So... if you find it helpful, use it. Don't overuse it. I mean, don't use it all the time. Only use it when you find yourself heavily distracted and you find that by counting it helps you to be more stable, then use it. And once you become more stable, then let it go. Because eventually in the practice, you'll have to let it go because it is conceptual activity where we're supposed to be focusing here. So... it could be a useful tool as a beginner to stabilize, but at some point you're going to need to let it go. So don't get over reliant on it. What was the other thing I was going to mention? So and then with the counting, don't just make it mindfulness of counting. So the main focus is still the sensations of the breath. So it's only very briefly at the end of the in-breath you mentally note one, two, three, and so forth. The rest of the breath on the out-breath and the following in-breath, you're focusing on the sensations. So the primary focus is still the sensations of the breath. It's just not mindfulness of counting. Okay?
Counting is just the antidote.
Counting could be a useful tool as a beginner to, because if you're occupying your mind with counting, it means... there's no space to get caught up in other distractions. So it's sort of tying your mind to something related to the breath. But some people find from the very beginning that counting is just another distraction. It's not useful. So then don't use it. If you don't find it useful, don't use it. If you find it useful, bring it in when you need it. And then when you're more stable, then let it go and go back. Okay, let's do the practice. As always, we begin by preparing the body, setting the body into a state of relaxation, stillness, and vigilance. Allowing the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. And setting the mind in a state of ease and relaxation. Letting go of all thoughts of the past or the future. And simply letting the mind rest in the present moment. Focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Now narrow the focus and focus on the sensations of the breath at the entrance of the nostrils. And maintain that ongoing flow of mindfulness of the sensations of the breath throughout the entire cycle of each in and out breath. Not trying to control or regulate the breath in any way. keeping all the muscles in the face soft and relaxed. once again, keeping the back straight, and allowing the body to become completely relaxed. Breathing, flowing naturally and effortlessly. And with each out breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen. In particular, letting go of any expectations for this meditation. And allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment. Focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. And narrowing the focus and focusing on the sensations of the breath at the entrance of the nostrils. Balancing the mind, overcoming agitation and distraction by relaxing and releasing any distractions on each out-breath. And overcoming dullness or just being spaced out by arousing and refreshing the focus on the breath, on each in-breath. So let's continue to practice in silence. Any questions or comments about this practice before we go back into the text? Just one thing I'd like to add. Continuing on about, we talked briefly about counting the breath. So again, if you find yourself very much distracted and you find that through counting the breath it helps to stabilize the mind, then bring it in when you need. Some traditions, instead of counting the breath, talk about noting or labeling, meaning that you mentally note breathing in, breathing out. So instead of counting, you can use that noting or labeling. If you do use that, make sure you keep it very simple. Don't make it too elaborate. Otherwise, it just becomes more commentary. So again, if you find those sort of things helpful as a beginner, then bring them in when you need. Otherwise, don't use them. And eventually, of course, we'll need to let it go. Okay, let's go back into the text now. So just to review a few points before we continue. So we're using this text here, The Main Path of the Victors, a root text for the precious Gelug Kagyu tradition of Mahamudra. So remember, Mahamudra, Sanskrit word, maha means great, mudra means stamp or seal. So when we talk about the stamp or seal, we're referring to emptiness. Emptiness is the nature of reality. Emptiness is how all phenomena exist, meaning all phenomena are empty of existing independently. So everything is stamped by emptiness, hence it's a mudra, stamp or seal. And when we come to realize this fact, we can achieve the goal of enlightenment. Therefore, it's great, maha, maha mudra, great seal. And this system of practice was brought into Tibet through the lineage, Indian lineage, the Mahamudra lineage, oral lineage of through Tolopa and Naropa, into Tibet through Marpa, Milarepa, Gampopa. So this forms the basis of the Kagyu school of Tibetan Buddhism. So in the Kagyu school, the main system of practice is Mahamudra. But here we're talking about the root text for the precious Gelug Kagyu tradition of Mahamudra. The Gelug school was founded by Lama Tsongkhapa in the 15th century. And he expanded upon the Lam Rim style of practice that was brought into Tibet through the great Indian master Lama Ratisha. And so in the Gelug school, the main system of practice that is taught is Lam Rim, stages of the path to enlightenment. But also Lama Tsongkhapa received teachings from some great Kagyu masters of his time. And through those Mahamudra instructions that he received, he synthesized those together with his own profound method for coming to realize emptiness, and established the Gelug system of Mahamudra, which was then passed down from Lama Tsongkhapa, and eventually it came down to Panchen Losan Chögyi Gyaltsen in the 16th, 17th century, and he wrote down these instructions that he received from his teacher, and hence we have this text here. And so this is what we are following, and in this text we saw that it's divided into three parts. The entering into the composition, the actual explanation, and the dedication of virtue. So entering into the composition, you'll find that in general, particularly in the Tibetan tradition, when they write a text, in the beginning there's two parts. There's first a homage, where they're praising someone or something. Here in this case, of course, we see that Panchen Losan Chögyi Gyaltsen is praising Mahamudra. He says, Namo Mahamudra. And then he's praising his own teacher who introduced the nature of the mind, Mahamudra, to him. And then he makes a promise to compose, to write the text, to complete the text. And then in the actual explanation, we see that it's also divided into three parts: the preliminaries, actual practice, and conclusion. So the preliminaries are the foundation practices for Mahamudra. What practices do we need to engage in to establish a good foundation to be able to engage in Mahamudra practice? Then there's the actual Mahamudra practice, and the conclusion involves what to do at the end of a meditation session, i.e. dedication, and then also what to do between meditation sessions to continue to cultivate that Mahamudra practice. And in the actual practice, we saw that the actual Mahamudra practice, we can do this at these two levels called Sutra and Tantra. Tantra level is, in Mahamudra practice, of course, we're coming to realize the nature of the mind. And in all practices, in the sutra level of practice, of course, we're using the coarse mind for meditation. The coarse mind is the mind we have now, the mind that's active. We're trying to refine that coarse mind. We're trying to make it more stable and clear through the shamatha practice. And then we're using that to penetrate the nature of reality, the vipassana practice. In the tantra level of practice, we are trying to gain access to a deeper level of mind, this very subtle mind, and use that in our vipassana practice. And if we can manage to do that, we can accelerate the spiritual path to enlightenment. And so the sutra level of Mahamudra practice, of course, is the basis for tantra. So that's the main emphasis in this text, is to establish the basis in sutra Mahamudra practice, in shamatha vipassana practice, so that later, then when we have a good basis, then we can enter into the tantra level of Mahamudra practice. So that's why he's explaining tantra Mahamudra first, very briefly, just to get an idea what it's about for future reference. So that's where we... before that, of course, we started to look at the preliminaries, the foundation practices. We only did a little bit of that because each day in the 2 o'clock session, we're going to continue to look at that section of the text, the preliminary practices. So now we're looking at the tantra level of the Mahamudra practice. And we saw there that Tantra Mahamudra is this luminosity, or luminosity is the translation here for this very subtle mind. It's the very subtle mind that's very blissful, has great bliss, that is realizing emptiness. And how to cause this to manifest, we saw here, was by manipulating subtle energies in the body, by withdrawing all subtle energies into the central channel, causing the heart chakra to open. So this practice in Tantra, of course, is what's called completion stage practice. In order for us to be able to do this, what we saw here in the text is, it says this is dependent upon having obtained the four pure empowerments. So the empowerments are what empower us to do the tantric practice, the generation stage practice and this completion stage practice. So therefore we need this as a basis, and then we read a little bit from this Pointing Out the Great Way Mahamudra book from Daniel Brown, because later we saw here in the tantra section, we saw that there are these things called dohas, these sort of songs of realization, and that very early in the Mahamudra tradition, often if the student was ready, then the master would simply sing, literally, his own experiential song about his own realization to the disciple, and that would trigger a realization of Mahamudra in the mind of the disciple. So therefore, sometimes this is what's called pointing out instructions, pointing out the nature of the mind. This sometimes is called essence Mahamudra. So sometimes we can talk about three levels of Mahamudra practice. So the essence level would simply involve the master giving some very short pointing out instructions, some very pithy instructions that would trigger this realization of Mahamudra within the mind of the student. For of course, for these pointing out instructions to be effective and work, requires the student to be already at a very high level. And if they're not, then they need to prepare for these pointing out instructions by engaging in the Tantra level of Mahamudra. And here in the text we talked about this subtle, manipulating subtle energies causing this luminosity, the very subtle mind to manifest. That is completion stage practice. But of course, to be able to do this subtle body manipulation of energies, we need a good basis, which is the generation stage practice in Tantra. But as we saw here in the text, is to even have a good basis for this generation stage practice, which involves visualizing ourselves in a fully enlightened form, doing various visualizations, reciting mantra. But at a deeper level, this involves effectively shamatha practice. It involves developing a high level of focus. Even to be able to do that, of course, we need a good basis. If we're not ready to do that, and we don't have that good basis, we need to develop that basis through the sutra level of Mahamudra practice. Through the shamatha and vipassana practice, through refining our coarse mind, through using that to come to realize emptiness. Because to have a basis for generation stage practice, we need the aspiration of bodhicitta, because we're striving for enlightenment. We need some experience or realization of emptiness. So we need these practices to do that. But of course, even to practice the shamatha and vipassana, we need the foundation, which is the preliminaries. So we need to engage in these preliminary practices. And so far, what we've seen in the preliminary section, that we need to have refuge, we need to have going for refuge to Buddha Dharma Sangha. We need the aspiration of bodhicitta. And to develop the aspiration of bodhicitta, of course, we need, as we saw last night, we need to cultivate loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, equanimity. So these included in the preliminaries. And as we're going to see this afternoon, there are other preliminary foundation practices that are necessary to have a basis for these practices. So this is sort of the order in which we need to cultivate the Mahamudra practice. Now, if we go back into the text here, we had a little bit more to go in the Tantra level of the practice. So I think we finished more or less page 2. So if we turn over onto top of page 3, there's a couple of paragraphs more about the Tantra level of practice that we can go through. And the first, it's quoting from Saraha, again, this great Indian master from the 8th century. And in one of his dohas, his spiritual songs of realization, he says, "By engaging in emptiness devoid of compassion, you will not find the supreme path. Alternatively, if you just cultivate compassion, you will remain here in samsara and will not attain liberation. Whoever is able to conjoin those two will not abide in samsara and will not abide in nirvana." So in general, of course, in the spiritual path, we need to cultivate these two wings of practice, of wisdom and compassion. And here we can talk about what's called the two extremes. One extreme, and this is an extreme in terms of abiding, one extreme is samsara. I mean, that's where we are now. We're stuck in this cycle of existence called samsara, with suffering, mental afflictions and suffering. How to get out of samsara is, as we've briefly seen already, is we need to come to realize the nature of reality. We need to come to realize emptiness. So the antidote to samsara is emptiness. And through that will enable us to achieve liberation from suffering, from samsara. It will enable us to achieve the goal of nirvana. But here he says, in the very first couple of lines, by engaging in emptiness, devoid of compassion, you will not find the supreme path. So here when he says supreme path, he's talking about the Mahayana path, the path to enlightenment. Because if we only cultivate emptiness, devoid of compassion, and here compassion, he means bodhicitta, then we're not going to achieve enlightenment. Because remember, the central pillar support for Mahayana path is bodhicitta. So if we come to realize emptiness, yes, we can overcome samsara and achieve nirvana, but we will not be able to achieve enlightenment. So from a Mahayana perspective, the goal of nirvana is an extreme. Because if we achieve the goal of nirvana and this life finishes, we end up in a solitary state of peace, completely isolated from everything else in the universe. In that state, of course, we can't help to liberate anyone. So from a Mahayana perspective, a Bodhisattva perspective, that's an extreme. We can't be of any use to anyone. Okay, we're not suffering, but we can't help anyone. So how to overcome nirvana is through the compassion wing. And by compassion here, we mean bodhicitta. So if we have developed the aspiration of bodhicitta as a basis, and then we engage in the practice of emptiness, then it says here, we will not abide in samsara and not abide in nirvana. We will have the supreme path to enlightenment. And then he comments, Panchen Losen Chikyi Losen comments on that. He says, therefore, it is necessary to join the subject, compassion. And here, of course, we're talking about the tantra level of practice, he says, which is the co-emergent great bliss. So that co-emergent great bliss of this very subtle mind is in the nature of bodhicitta and with the object emptiness. So we are conjoining emptiness and bodhicitta or compassion here, but in tantra this is often referred to as this blissful mind, the mind of great bliss. And then he goes on to say, as for generating the realization of this Mahamudra, so this Mahamudra, we're talking about Tantra Mahamudra, if the winds enter, abide and dissolve in the central channel, through having trained in the preceding paths, the preceding paths are these, in previous lives or in earlier part of this life, then such a person can actualize Mahamudra, or luminosity. So luminosity is the very subtle mind realizing emptiness, by observing any suitable object, such as resting in a non-conceptual mind. Previous Kagyu masters gave this person the name the simultaneous one. So the simultaneous one is this person here, the person who, due to a lot of effort at these levels of practice earlier in this life or from a previous life, receive some pointing out instructions from the master, and then they achieve enlightenment. That's why it's called simultaneous one. And then he goes on to say, for all other trainees, it is definitely necessary to meditate on tummo and so forth in order to actualize the Mahamudra of this path. Tummo is one of these practices of completion stage. You know, we talked in the earlier explanation, we talked about needing to penetrate the vital points of the subtle vajra body, you know, focusing on the chakras. Tummo is one such practice. Tummo is focusing on the navel chakra. And this is very well famous in Tibet, because by focusing on the navel chakra, it does help to cause the winds dissolve in the central channel. But one of the side effects of tummo practice is you develop a lot of inner heat. It's called literally inner heat. Tummo means inner heat. And so there have been some experiments done with Tibetan yogis who do the tummo practice, and they can raise the temperature of their body. You know, they can go and sit out in the snow and be warm because of the tummo practice. But of course, that's a side effect. That's not the goal of tummo practice. Tummo practice is a completion stage practice to cause the luminosity, the very subtle mind, to become manifest. So he says that in order to do this, then most people need to not only do tummo, but they need to do all of these practices to be at that state. So someone here, and it says here, he goes on to say, accordingly, with respect to meditating on the Mahamudra indicated here, it is necessary... Oh, hang on, sorry, did I miss something? Yeah, that's right. It is necessary to obtain the four pure empowerments, which is the door of entry into the Tantra level of practice, and to also train in the common paths. The common paths are the preliminary practices plus the shamatha and vipassana. The generation completion stage, so forth. Such a person is given the name the serial one. Thus, even most of the great adepts of this path entered into the lineage of empowerment of the various classes of Anuttara Yoga Tantras. Therefore, what he's saying is that for most of us, then, of course, because we haven't done all this work earlier in our life or in a previous life, we need to go through this in a serial manner, meaning we need to establish a good foundation in the preliminary practices, then on that basis engage in shamatha, vipassana practice. Once we have some experience there, then we can take an empowerment, enter into the generation stage practice. Once we've developed a good basis there, then we can enter into the completion stage practice. And once we have a good foundation there, then we can receive these pointing out instructions from the master, and they can make some, they can have some effect. Any questions on anything that I've covered here now this morning? Yeah.
My question is regarding the extremes, the second one, Nirvana. You said at Nirvana stage, you can be out of samsara, but you cannot help other sentient beings.
Yeah.
Can you open that up, please?
Right. So, Nirvana is a state of liberation, personal liberation from suffering. So if we were to sit here now and realize emptiness, and of course one realization of emptiness is not going to get us out of samsara, as we're going to see later in this retreat, but eventually, if we keep realizing emptiness, we'll eventually eliminate all of our ignorance and mental afflictions, we'll achieve the state of nirvana. From that state then, in that state of nirvana, then yes, of course, we can go about and help others. But if our motivation was to achieve that as our goal, then what happens is, at the end of this very short life, when this body finishes, because we have got out of samsara, there's no impetus to be reborn again. So what happens is someone who's achieved nirvana and that was their goal, at the end of this life, there's nothing to cause them to be reborn in the world again. So they end up in a mental state of solitary peace. And in that state, they do not take physical form and they're completely at peace, but they are completely isolated from everything else in the universe. So that's what we're referring to here, that state of nirvana once this body is finished.
There's no rebirth.
Yeah, there's no rebirth because we've got rid of the... Because we're reborn because of our mental afflictions. So they're gone, so there's nothing to cause us to be reborn. Only, yes, if you have this. Because if you have bodhicitta, that aspiration is the cause to appear again. But we're not reborn in the normal sense. So if we don't have that, and we achieve this goal, when this body finishes, we end up in a solitary state of peace, and that's it. And within the Theravada tradition, because the goal of the Theravada practice is this, the way they describe this state once the body finishes at the end of the life is that they say it's like a candle going out. Nothing left. And then you say, well, what does that mean? They say it's inexpressible. But it's almost like the mind goes out of existence, the way it's explained. From a Mahayana perspective, that's a little bit illogical. So the Mahayana explanation for that is that you end up in what's called a mental body. So you don't take physical form, you just end up, your mind is still there, and you end up in this state of solitary peace, but you have no, because you're not taking any physical form, there's no connection with anything, anyone or anything in the universe. So you're just completely isolated in this state of solitary peace. And in that state, you can't help anyone. And you stay in that state, according to Mahayana, is that even if your aspiration originally was to achieve that state and you end up in that state, you don't stay in that state forever. According to Mahayana, it's a temporary state. You will stay in that state for a very long time, but eventually you'll pop out of that state and understand you haven't completed the path. You will take physical form somewhere and continue with the aspiration of bodhicitta to achieve enlightenment. So that's the Mahayana assertion. So from Mahayana perspective, if you end up in this state, then while you're in that state, you can't help anyone. So it's an extreme. So that to avoid that extreme, bodhicitta. Because as a bodhisattva, we... On the way to enlightenment, we achieve this state of getting out of samsara as a byproduct, but then we don't get stuck in that state because this is the cause for us to appear again in the world, that motivation.
We have one more question about the same.
About the...
It's the same.
Same.
Isn't compassion a kind of a natural quality of Buddha nature? Isn't compassion a natural quality?
Natural quality.
Yeah, simple people, but
yeah,
we
sure.
have compassion. And as people,
sure.
I can't believe that such a highly realized being is
yeah.
as an arhat, he doesn't have compassion.
Right.
That doesn't
right.
sound right.
Right. Yeah, as Dalai Lama says, is we all have biological compassion. You know, we have compassion for our children, for our family, for our community, biological compassion. That's quite natural, as you said. But it's not natural to have compassion for people we don't know, and it's certainly not natural to have compassion for people who harm us. That's not natural. In fact, most people react with anger towards people who harm us. So that's opposite of compassion. So we have to cultivate that. So yesterday evening when we talked about four immeasurables, that's compassion for everyone. So we have to develop our natural compassion, our biological compassion. We have to expand that further to include people we don't know, to include people who harm us, to include all sentient beings. That's not natural. That's what we have to cultivate. And our heart has that. So they have that compassion. But here in the text, when he's using the word compassion, he's referring to this, this aspiration of bodhicitta. And our heart does not have this. And our heart has the aspiration for their own liberation from suffering. And together with that, of course, they will have compassion not just for their friends, they will have compassion for all sentient beings, yes, but they will not have the motivation that I myself alone am going to take personal responsibility to liberate every single sentient being. That's bodhicitta. And our heart doesn't have that. So that's what he's referring to here. If we don't have this, then we're going to get stuck in nirvana. So in our heart, get stuck in nirvana because they don't have compassion in terms of bodhicitta. But yes, you're right. An arhat definitely has compassion for all sentient beings, and they try to help all sentient beings as much as they can. And we naturally have compassion for people close to us. Yes, that's true.
One related question. Sometimes I really think about if this world, it didn't have any beginning. Yeah, everything just continues without beginning, and already there must have been numerous enlightened beings and numerous bodhisattvas who once decided to help other beings to become enlightened. So in this eternal time, like time with no limits, everything, it must have already.
Right. But a couple of points.
If we are here now and this haven't yet happened, so it is somehow this eliminates my hope and belief that this will ever happen.
Right. Two quick answers to that, and then we'll take a tea break. First is when we entertain these questions, often we entertain them with the assumption that there is some fixed linear time, which science has proven does not exist. There is no fixed objective time, even according to physics. So that's one point we have to sort of get our head around. Yeah, we have to look at what do we mean by time. So the idea of beginningless time and the idea that means some fixed linear objective history is false according to physics and certainly false according to Buddhism. So that's one point. And second point, of course, is that the limiting factor is from our side, not from an enlightened person's side. An enlightened person can't wave a magic wand and then fix us. So we could be living with enlightened people around us and see them as ordinary people and see them as bad people. In fact, the Buddha, when he was enlightened, his cousin Devadatta thought he was a fraud and tried to kill him. So he didn't see him as enlightened. So just because someone's enlightened doesn't mean we'll see them as enlightened. In fact, unfortunately, in our modern society, often people who have those high levels of realization, even before they're enlightened, they do not often behave according to our social norms, our social standards, because they have a completely different perspective. They're not unethical, but their behavior doesn't fit with what we think is normal. So we often see that, and we often think, oh, they're crazy, they're mentally disturbed. And fortunately,
this doesn't happen. So somehow it sounds unrealistic.
It doesn't happen.
It doesn't happen. Yeah.
From your perspective, it doesn't happen. And for most of us, it doesn't happen. And the reason it doesn't happen is because of our deluded mind. It's not because it's not happening. It's because we don't see it happening.
I mean, about that final goal for every being to be liberated.
Sure.
I mean that final goal. This goal seems somehow unrealistic.
Completely crazy. But we need to have that completely crazy aspiration to achieve enlightenment. Okay, let's have a tea break, and yeah, maybe after the break. We're running late, so we can ask the question after the break. Okay, so let's have a tea break and come back at 10:45.